Blog Talk Radio.
Don Show. My name is Don Allen over in Studio A, chilling out. And over in Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, what's going on?
Don, you know, I want to bounce the basketball.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't want to feel like the Harlem Globetrotters necessarily. A lot of things going on. But, man, I don't know that I'd want to be the NAACP in Southern California tonight, if you know what I mean. So,
yeah.
You got that? Geez, we've got a cycle of violence that exploded on the scene here this afternoon at the big county hospital, MCHC as they call it, Hennepin County Medical Center. Gunman opens fire, and a couple of people are wounded, if you will. Gunman is apprehended and has been in custody.
Now, were there any...
You know,
yeah, were there any heroes in that that incident downtown?
Well, yes, a couple of police officers, if you will, of the downtown command facing off against the officer, and then we're also told that a sergeant, a female sergeant by the name of Jane Moore, very much involved in the face-off, if you will, with the gunman, who was an African-American. I mean, I'm saddened to say that, but then the people that were injured were African-Americans, if you will. Gunman fired at least anywhere from 8 to 12 shots, depending on how many shell casings that they find. Witnessed by many doctors and nurses at MCHC in downtown Minneapolis, if you will. And then immediately following that, though not connected, fighting breaks out at the Central Library here in downtown Minneapolis and all along the Nicollet Mall.
Oh, no.
Young people involved in skirmishes, clashes, and et cetera, if you will. On a night in which the Minnesota Twins-Los Angeles Dodger game has been canceled again because of rain. Boy, that's a lot of money that was lost, and I don't think they're going to be able to reschedule. That's going to be very interesting, if you will. So we had heroes down there today. We had gunmen opening fire, shooting into cars, shooting into the hospital, if you will. A lot of folks didn't want to believe that it was happening, you know what I mean? But we are in a cycle of violence here, gang violence here. It was gang-related, unfortunately, Don.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I thought we had that in the control.
The gunman actually was an individual who just a couple weeks ago was a patient at that same hospital and actually had come to the hospital for some medical care on a wound that he had received when he was ambushed and shot outside of the Twins target field after completing his duties as an after game worker, part of the maintenance crew. He and another young African American leaving the facility were ambushed right there by the light rail station. And the gunman, Kippy, was wounded, but the young man with him was shot and paralyzed, if you will, was to become the second young African-American shot and paralyzed within an eight-day period. 8 days later, young African-American, as part of the same conflict, was shot along the 1400 block of DuPont Avenue North. Right across from Ascension Church, if I'm not mistaken, I remember correctly, whatever. And he was paralyzed. And so this is a part of an ongoing conflict involving some of the toughest gangs here in the Twin Cities, if you will, the SUBs, the 1-9s, and the Taliban, which is the gang that appears to be the target of the others. Vice Lords are being rejuvenated here, if you will, Gangster Disciples, GD, you know. It's wild. We've had shootings every night for the last 14 nights here in the Twin Cities, and particularly in Minneapolis, gunfire going off. Makes you think, Don, and it's back in the old days that you were in Baghdad or, you know, someplace like that. It's gunfire everywhere. But this is kind of bold. Gunman, in fact, he went back to his car, got his weapons, actually pulled up right in front of the main door to MCHC and opened fire.
Wow.
On a car containing four individuals, including two women, two young women that apparently were the target of his wrath and response. So that's the situation right now, if you will. Also, we had a death over in Cedar Riverside. Initially, people thought that it was a shooting or beating, but it appears it was an overdose.
Mm.
Yeah, wow. So a lot of the heroin traffic is still moving through certain in many communities, and the gang violence is just absolutely out of control. People are dreading when we get some warm and non-inclement kind of weather, what's going to happen. I just don't know how they're going to get a handle on it, Don. But we've got a lot of money's been awarded here and spent, and we're hearing a lot of stories about a lot of young African Americans are working and all those other kinds of things, yet you can't find them. So I just don't, I just try to stay on my side of the highway, Don.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. So I just was looking at the news, Mr. Edwards. There's so many headlines for the NAACP takes money from Donald Sterling. And, you know, NPR did a big piece today on why would the NAACP honor this man. And it's shocking because, as we talked about in our production meeting, Mr. Edwards, we have been talking about this and telling people about even our NAACPs here in the Twin Cities. And, you know, we've been told to stand down, that wasn't the case. You know, we don't have anyone that will go shake down the Minnesota Sports Facility Authority, MnDOT, or anybody like that.
Whoops.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, and
yeah,
so
yeah,
you
give
know,
a little time to that one because I tell you there's some hot. Well, I'm saddened by what has happened to the school district, special school district number one, which is the school district for the city of Minneapolis. Some controversy has emerged. People are saying that a $50,000 contract was awarded under political pressure. To some individuals, one of them being a man involved with the shutdown of a charter school under his tutelage, if you will, and the disappearance of over $600,000 from an organization, a used-to-be organization, now defunct, called City Inc. $59,000 contract. I know, Don, that you've really been on top and out front on this, but people are saying that no such document exists, if you will, and I'm saying, well, how would you know? You know what
yeah,
I'm saying?
Exactly.
But I was informed yesterday by a number of African-American educators that some way or another they came into possession of both the proposal, which could have been written by a third grader, and I don't want to insult our third grade children, but really that's what it was. And then the actual contract for $59,000 over 2 months from 4/14/14 to 6/14/14.
Well,
that's a nice payday.
Yeah, well, Mr. Everett, if I may, I would like to diffuse any misinformation that's out there right now. And you know, on April 10th of this month, April 10th at about 2:30 p.m., I sent a data request to the Minneapolis Public Schools. They answered.
I understand you did that, Don. Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And they answered on April 28th. And
a little bit behind schedule, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
To answer
yeah.
within, what, 5, 10 days?
Yeah, and so people know that I'm going to tell you exactly what I asked for. So in response to the data request, I request a copy of any records, contracts, agreements, signed or unsigned, for a truancy programmer operated or planned by William Dill.
You said truancy, yeah, truancy program, correct.
Truancy program, yes. Planned by William Bill English and or Jerry McAfee of the NAACP. I would also like a copy of the plan from the awardees, if any, and the dollar amount to be paid for this service agreement. Now, I got bullet points from 1 through 7 from the school district, okay? And they got really nervous, Mr. Edwards, because this is like already creating a stink, but they still got nervous because, one, they said there is no contract for a truancy program operator planned by William.
I understand English. That's what they said, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then number two, there is no contract for a truancy program operator planned by Jerry McAfee in force at this time. Three, there is no contract or truancy program planned by the NAACP in force this time. A little bit different than the NAACP meeting that will happen, the general membership meeting a couple weeks ago. Four, I attached a proposal for such truancy program to be operated and planned by William Bill English. I've attached a draft, a contract for such a truancy program. I've attached additional information offered by Bill English in support of creating such a contract. I have been informed that no contract will be entered into this fiscal year based on a proposal made by Bill English. So when I go down here and let's just pull up.
Now, Don, when you're talking this, but you are because this is not television. I mean, I have to say this from the left. And my understanding is the contract was not with the NAACP. It was with the religious facility of New Salem. But you're looking at what? So that we are listening audience.
Okay,
I'm looking at
the draft.
Draft?
For 11 weeks and for 18 weeks for the truancy program, which hires a program coordinator 20 hours a week at $25 an hour for a total of 18 weeks for $9,000. Program manager 20 hours a week for 18 weeks at $7,000. FTE intervener, whatever that is. And another FTE.
That's kind of the person that handles mediation.
Yeah. And so, it's a pretty hefty total staffing salaries were 27. Well, actually, total staffing salaries for the full 18 weeks was $40,500. Transportation and insurance, would be $6,000 to $8,000. Evaluation design, interim, a final report. They're charging for a final report. Ain't that a shame? $4,500. Supplies, anywhere ranging from $1,100 to $2,000. And other expenses, $2,850. Total grant amount for the 11 weeks was $42,000. Administrative support was $6,000. And for a grand total of 18 weeks, for $59,973. Rounded off to...
Now, Don, are you sure about those figures? Because you gave quite a few couple thousand, 18 weeks.
Yeah, oh, yeah, I've added
weeks.
I've added up several times. They are correct. The total
okay.
is, for 18 weeks, it was $59,973.
Oh, 18 weeks. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
For 11 weeks, it's $48,616. So that's what
okay,
I'm looking...
Okay, well, the contract, though, there's a date there. Again, we want to be as transparent to our listening audience, and, of course, our phone lines are always open. Was that it was from 4/14/14 through 6/14/14. So that would be, what, approximately 9 weeks, 10 weeks?
Yeah.
Both, April and April's 30 days, because, in fact, this is the last day of April. We would have been into, May would have been technically, 14th of May would have been 1 month, and then the 14th of June would have been the 2 months. So, that was 8, 9 weeks. So, who was the administrator per se? I'm not understanding. How much
I'm
was the administrator
here,
going to be paying?
Let me go back to that real quick. But real quick here, Mr. Harris, I'm looking one from Salem Inc. Educational Initiatives. CEO Director William English, and like you said, from 4/14 to 6/14. It looks like yeah.
6/14. Mm-hmm.
And. It has Michael Thomas, school board approver, and Melissa Jackson, Minneapolis Public Schools approver. And it says draft.
Ms. Jackson, for clarification and transparent, Ms. Jackson who's Caucasian, is the principal at Bethune, because you forgot to mention where what the site would be. The site will be Bethune in North Minneapolis. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was going to the third contract to read that.
How many contracts do they have? God, wow.
Yeah, there's like three versions, and let me just download this last one because it's absolutely ludicrous. And I mean, if you saw this proposal and if you write proposals, you'd be utterly embarrassed of the typos and the kind of crap these people are putting out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to do family support. Now, shouldn't they have gone, if anywhere, to NAS, Northside Achievement Zone, and gotten some money from them for family support? Because that's what NAS is supposed to be doing altogether. And so
the reason would have been, Mr. Allen, though, is that Bethune is not in NAB's area of authorization.
Wow. Well,
NAB has to work within a specific area, though clearly they have not been. Bethune is approximately 9 blocks outside of the area.
Okay.
Yeah, NAB has to work within a specific area.
Wow. That's incredible. That's just incredible.
Yeah,
but yeah,
let me just say this. If it had been at Nellie Stone Johnson as an example, then that would have been within NAB's area of responsibility. But Bethune, grade school, K through 6, is not within their area. And so there would have had to have been a federal waiver by the Federal Department of Education to have allowed the facilitation of a program in which NAB, Northside Education Zone, whatever, to have facilitated and spent any of their $22 million.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So our phone lines are open, 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. You want to call and talk about this? We invite you to give us a jingle.
Let me go back, and we certainly the lines are. But now you named a couple of individuals that I've clarified who I'm aware who Miss Jackson is. Now, Mr. Thompson is a associate superintendent, area superintendent of the Minneapolis School District, Special District Number 1, and of course Bethune is within his area of administrative responsibility. So. Now, when did the board vote on this?
I don't know, but it has here approval details. Approver, it had both their names, their email address, and approver type. Thomas is the school board approver, and Jackson is the Minneapolis Public Schools approver.
Well, wait a minute. I'm really a little confused there, Mr. Allen, because I know the protocol, and I have to say this from the left. Dr. Thompson could not be the school board's approver because the school board, by law, only the superintendent could act as approver for the district and the school board with concurrence by the chair of the school district, and that would be Richard Mammum, who is the now chair. So I'm a little puzzled. Do you think that's a typo or what? Because I can understand Principal Jackson on behalf of the and what was her title again? I mean, she was approver on behalf of whom now? The institution or the facility or the location?
Yep. It says that this person is approving. See, what it is a template contract, it looks like, that they made up, and it's really terribly written. And it has a little box with their names in it, like it's official, like this is official stuff. But it's garbage, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that from the left, but the fact of the matter is this is taxpayers' dollars, irrespective of if it's a administrative or execution, if you will. In other words, that it is at the prerogative of the superintendent to facilitate said monies, because there's probably a $60,000 cap that would require anything over $59,999 would have to be reviewed and vetted by the board, the elected board of education, and anything under 59999 could be executed at the discretion, keyword discretion, of the superintendent. That's why I'm just kind of questioning here in the studio looking at the documents, because Thompson's name catches me a little bit by surprise. I would have expected that you would have said the name of Superintendent Bernadette Johnson, Mr. L.
No, her name does not appear on any of these documents.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, phone lines are open, and for all those people that say they're so knowledgeable about what's happening in the world of education and et cetera, lines are open. Maybe they could help us explain to us how this happened. I know that Mr. English specifically had been on the premises during the week of just prior to the 14th of April, and for a period of time during the week of the 14th of April, I expect, in preparation. Now, is this contract being executed as we speak, or
No, actually, it is not being executed because they said, the school district said that they will not be approving any of this contract for this year, period. This will not be a contract.
You mean this school year, yes. Yeah, because they knew quarter starts and a new school year would start on August, 28th, 29th. I mean, I'm puzzled. Truancy, there are a number of entities, basically government, if you will, that deal with issue of truancy. You've indicated some facilitation that would be carried out as part of this private contract. So, yeah, kind of beyond me, kind of fast, if you will. Well, what else? The phone lines are open. And if there are any questions, probably maybe there are no questions. Maybe folks are comfortable with that and with these kinds of arrangements.
Yeah, I'm absolutely sure, Ms. Ayers, that they're comfortable because that's been going on for a while. But, locally here, I mean, we've been on the national NAACP quite a bit here and watching these newscasts and all these headlines that, this Donald Sterling has donated a lot of money to them, but we can't find out the amount. And they're not going to release the amount, but until a court makes them release the amount. But here locally, we seem to have a decaying of our Minneapolis branch of the NAACP. I understand that the third vice president, Ilion, has resigned. I know the treasurer resigned, and I think there's a little bit more trouble headed that way. So it's pretty interesting.
Oh, my. Well, let me – we're having a call. I'm having a call here in studio coming in on another line. Why don't you kind of indicate who, again, the personnel were, and I'll be right back with you.
Okay, thank you. Well, anyway, what's going on is the Minneapolis NAACP, they managed to get me out of there because I was kind of watching very closely. And, the people that were to make the shots or to make the calls, it actually should have been Reverend Jerry McAfee to call the meetings. But they had Louis King calling meetings and to what to tell Linda Higgins when they met with her the Thursday a few weeks back. And I didn't feel like that was, appropriate. I didn't feel like, being a puppet for anybody, especially Louis King or Jerry McAfee. And so with that said, I confronted Reverend McAfee several times via email, via, phone conversation. He said, hey, we're not going to use white guilt and go down to the Minnesota Sports Facility Authority and get some money from them. I said, what will you do with that? Where is the plan? But the funny thing is, Mr. Edwards, nothing has ever been put on paper. Not anything.
Yeah. Well, something's on paper with respect to this truancy situation and truancy contract. Well, I just hope there wasn't any political pressure placed on the district or the superintendent to facilitate this. There are rumors, but at this point they're merely that. They are rumors, if you will, that is out there. Don, I have a call coming on the private line. Hold just a minute.
Okay. The in-studio private lines, just let me tell you, that's executive stuff. By the way, you're listening to the Ron and Don Show on Blog Talk Radio, broadcasting live from downtown Minneapolis Apple Studio, where only few can tread. And we are honored. So, Mr. Edwards, we have a caller calling in, or?
This was a caller that's kind of doing like they've kind of been doing there.
Okay.
So they'd have to call in if they had any questions. They have some questions about how long has this been negotiated. I said, well, you know, prefer that you put that on the air and ask the questions. So that's up to these callers. With the text messages, I will not, as you said and indicated last week, we will not be dealing with quote-unquote text message questions. This is a call-in radio program. If you want to have information on this, this is what you need to ask. Including Mr. Allen, I imagine that you are ready to speak to the fact that there have been significant. Now, is it completely factual that both the first, second, and third vice presidents have stepped down?
That's what I'm saying.
As well as the treasurer.
The treasurer. And I understand the assistant treasurer has stepped down, and I know the assistant secretary is not doing much. And well, the secretary is not doing very much, and the assistant secretary, she's still there. She's clinging on for unknown reasons, but there are known reasons, but we don't want to slander her on the air. So, but she is still there, and so we're just kind of wondering what the heck is going on, you know. Is this not something that they knew from the very start, that this current infrastructure of the Minneapolis NAACP was very disrespectful to black women? And so they found out the hard.
Well, let me just say this, though. The folks, of course, you are the former second vice president, so, you know, you're absolutely, qualified to talk in terms of what has gone on in the inside, but you know, we certainly want to provide balance, if you will, on this program, particularly in light of what's happened to the NAACP in Southern California and the allegations that they took money from Donald Sterling to facilitate Donald Sterling's continued pursuit, effective pursuit of racism, if you will, and his at least three anti-discrimination lawsuits that he was involved in, two in housing, one in employment, involving the general manager of his Los Angeles Clipper team. And so have we heard anything from the regional NAACP or state conference directors? They seem to have been very much involved in the move to oust you because of your political affiliations. Are they stepping up to the plate on anything here?
Haven't heard a peep out of them. Haven't heard a peep out of them at all. And so, I mean, no answered emails from them. Did get an email, Mr. Edwards, from Gil Ford, Reverend Ford out in Maryland, when I asked for a hearing, who said there didn't need to be a hearing, you know, and after I, you know, told him about, you know, it was very interesting that they used the money paid online, and then if it's paid online and the branch or the headquarters does not send your $11.70 to the local branch, that you cannot hold an office on the executive committee, even though that Mr. Jordan did say specifically on December 13th that the bylaws didn't apply here because this was a special election to get the branch started again. And
so
with that said, it was found out through some digging in Maryland that the Minneapolis NAACP actually received my money in December.
Oh, okay.
And so,
Reverend Ford, who is the director of branches for the powerful NAACP, felt that there should not be a hearing or examination on that particular issue. The documentation shows that your money showed up suddenly on the 30th of December, but Reverend Ford indicated that your position was still invalidated because it was not in place on the 13th of December. Is that correct, Mr. Allen?
That is correct. That is correct.
Okay.
And there was no way for them to even collect money and deposit it in a bank here locally because they didn't open the account for about a month after the election.
Well, so I thought they had an account, but maybe had a couple hundred dollars in it.
Well, I guess I can put it like this.
Did they have an account?
The transfer was not made from the old guard to the new guard. That took a while.
Once
that was made, you know, we're talking January. And in January, you know, that was too really, you know, it was really, if, anyway, to make a long story short, Mr. Edwards, they were out of line, and there was the reasons that they were saying were absolutely false, constructed to, you know, to make sure that I wasn't around.
Yeah. Well, again, the phone line's 1-347-426-3904. Again, the number 341-426-3904. Phone lines are open about the truancy and also controversy emerging once again about the NAACP, both nationally and locally, if you will. God, we really need to, you know, in light of the shootings at the medical center, the general hospital this afternoon. Boy, we really need to get a handle. We had a big peace summit here a couple weeks ago. Star Tribune wrote about it, made mention of it. Folks indicated that the order was going to be brought to bear, if you will. I know the authorities have been conducting raids and things like that, so apparently information is being provided to them about who are allegedly the bad guys, I assume, you know what I mean? But in the meanwhile, the violence continues. I mean, that was a, you know, very bold a criminal act at the Hennepin County HCMC facility, a massive facility, if you will. Quite a bold move this afternoon. I'm not expecting that we will hear anything from leadership, but we should. I was expecting to hear before the 6 o'clock news that the chief Danae Hartel's citizen oversight committee would have made some kind of statement, particularly to the increased violence, the frequency of violence, young African-Americans, male and female, you know, being gunned down in the streets. I mean, we look like a version of Little Chicago. You know what I'm saying? But I guess that's too much to ask for.
That's way too much to ask for. Well, you know, well, here at Mr. Edwards, it's a lot different here, and I know I'm singing to the choir when I tell you this, but, you know, if this series of violent outbreaks in Minneapolis, these people will not call a press conference. Well, no one would come, first of all, but they will not make an effort to address it from a grassroots level. What they do is they sit back and say, oh, yeah, we can take care of that. You give us some money. You know, it takes a grant for them to move these people. And that's a really terrible thing, but that's just what's been going on for a long time here. And people at some point should get tired of it. You know, they should get absolutely tired of it.
Well, I would think so, Mr. Allen, because, you know, young people, old people, but young people specifically are being shot, killed, paralyzed, wounded, you know, traumatized, and et cetera. I've been waiting as an observer, backbencher, if you will, for when the move was going to commence, when we were going to see citizen patrols in the hot zones and hot spots, if you will. It's just not happening, if you will. In fact, at one point I heard that youngsters were going to be recruited by some of the organizers for the group, and they were going to be detailed to OIC here in Minneapolis for immediate training and employment and et cetera. That was a big discussion piece 3 weeks ago. Things kind of come and go and disappear, kind of go up in a puff of smoke, but we really don't have that luxury here in our beloved Shangri-La, if you will, and not with the kind of shootings going on. As I said before, this was a rather sensational act this afternoon, early this afternoon, midday, right in downtown Minneapolis. The gunman just pulls his car right up there at the front door in the circle there that you go around, you know, and wow, you know. So, but, you know, maybe the absence of calls, phone calls, and et cetera, folks are not concerned. You know, maybe it's okay, you know. so much for it. Well, what else do we have, Mr. Allen, at this particular point on our agenda?
Well, I'm looking at some things here locally. I know that in January 2014, Mayor Betsy Hodges and the St. Paul Mayor, Chris Coleman, said that they were to work in a year to end veterans' homelessness. And because, you know, there's like 3,300 homeless veterans at any given night in the state of Minnesota. A lot of those are based here, you know, homeless veterans are around the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul. It's funny because we haven't heard anything from either of these folks, these mayors, since January, after, you know, when they get elected, go through inauguration and get up there and tell them all, tell us all this great stuff they're going to do, they're going to perform, they're going to make happen for the people of Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Well, but let me ask this question, in all fairness to the Democratic administration, if you will, to my liberal friends. Now, do we have an Office of Veterans Affairs here for the city of Minneapolis?
Oh, yeah, you have an office.
We don't.
There's Veterans Service Officers downtown Minneapolis in the Hennepin County Government Center.
Well, but that's the federal and state of Veterans Affairs facilities. I'm talking about an Office of Veterans Affairs because in order to alleviate a problem at different levels, in this case a municipal level, you want to have a hands-on from the municipal authority. And so normally the way you do that, you have an office that addresses itself to that. At least you have a coordinator or such. So we have a coordinator, Ms. Hodges, Mayor Hodges, I'm sorry, Mayor Hodges. Did she appoint a coordinator for Veterans Affairs for our beloved city?
Unless she's using Sherman Patterson, who is a first sergeant. A
no, for Sherman handles all police matters.
Yeah, no, there's nothing going on. There's not a damn thing happening with that. So I just found it really interesting in this area was that they would even talk and play like that because, you know, this is a pretty serious issue. And to say something like that and not follow through on it, you know, they need a throttling.
Well, maybe some of our city council members, if we all know, listen and tune in on this program, maybe they could give us a call. Line, you know, we have the phone lines there, the numbers open, and kind of indicate to us where the council is at. I mean, this council has been passing all kinds of legislation. I mean, last week we talked about the, in fact, on our special broadcast, even this past Sunday from here in Minneapolis, in talking about indigenous holidays, Somali holidays, you know, let's grow more flowers, let's have more greenery, if you will. Let's get more beer taverns or breweries, as they call them, and et cetera. So, you know, should we take a little bit more serious the plight of our veterans? Or as you said before, I mean, I hate to think that my friends on the liberal side of the aisle were just really playing a game to cultivate veterans' votes. I mean, they wouldn't do that, would they, huh?
No, they might, you know, but we don't have one person that will call us and explain to us in a rational way about this Hodges administration and what they're doing with all these social issues rather than the brick-and-mortar stuff that they need to be doing to address some items from that 2010 disparity report. And people get really upset,
okay,
Mr. Edwards, with finding out, especially some white folks. I'm going to talk about you white folks, too. They get upset when you talk about that. They're like, well, you know, can't you just, you know, move on or leave it alone or, you know, what are you complaining about? Are you a victim? And no, that's hardly the case. You know, the case is that, you know, there were the people that were here before us fought, died, bled to make sure that not only the federal government, but these local city and the state governments put things in their regulations, their constitutions, their rules.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure that there was a process followed so there was a fair playing field.
Well, let me do this. Let me do this because the people that are outside of our, you know, Minnesota, Minneapolis are probably saying, well, you know, what are these guys talking about? Don't they have their act together? Of course, these things have been going on for, you know, 3 or 4 decades. Let's take an example because you and I were at that meeting in January of 2013, and we were told when we asked the question about veterans' preference for the stadium, the big billion dollar to our listing on it, the stadium that was going to be built here. We asked about veterans' preference, and Velma Corvell, who has just been reappointed as Civil Rights Director for the Civil Rights Department of Minneapolis, indicated there would be no veterans' preference, and then
she was confronted. She initially said that we lied and never asked that question, but my associate, Mr. Allen, recorded both audio and video of Ms. Corvell telling that story. And so she was, in fact, admonished and confronted by then Council Member Gary Schiff. Now, I said to you last week, Mr. Allen, we needed to try to get Alex Tittle, the equity director of the Stadium Authority, because they are now, dealing with the issue of employment and employment and numbers on the People's Stadium. First of all, the governor had been told that 7,500 individuals will work on this stadium, an average of 1,500 individuals will be there each and every day from now until July of 2016. You know, it's too bad that we don't give Mr. Tittle a call and ask him if he could share with us the hours that have already been worked by veterans. I know that when we asked the question about persons of color and minorities and women, whatever that's supposed to mean when you talk about minorities, but when we talk about people of color, African Americans, and et cetera, that can be forthcoming. But let's be patriotic here today. You know, the men and women of America's armed forces, both current and past, are there. They're with us. They've made it, have afforded us the opportunity to be pretty comfortable, and they certainly have afforded us the opportunity to exercise First Amendment. And as some would say, run our mouths and raise questions. You know, I just wish that if Alex was listening, that Alex would give us a call and just give us the number, the hours that have already been worked by the Armed Services of the United States of America, how many hours they've worked. Now, I gave you a figure last week that based on my long familiarity with this, that we should already have probably 12 to 13,000 hours already have been worked by persons of color, African Americans alone, and my numbers say that we certainly should have had probably based on the 32% factor, we should certainly have anywhere from 7,000 to 9,000 hours have already been worked for veterans. And I bet you there's no one out there that will dial the telephone and say, you know, either that's true or that's not. But at what point do we get the numbers? I mean, I'm hearing all kinds of rhetoric, if you will. I mentioned at the top of the program specifically that we were being told, and it was being said at the gang summit, that young men were going to be brought to the negotiation table, mediation, if you will, and that as a part of bringing peace and order, you know, that they were going to be referred to OIC, to my good friend Louis King. They were going to be trained and put to work, and this would begin to reduce violence in our city. And yet this afternoon we have a gunman who unfortunately is African-American, opens fire at HCMC, one of the largest hospitals in the United States. Doctors and nurses witnessed it. They were terrified. Of course, they treated the victims as they lay, if you will. Car shot up, gunman fires, 9, 10, 12, 13 shots. I mean, so, I would just hope that before we're off the air here in about 45 minutes, we'll be going until 10.
Okay,
I just hope someone
can
call us and say, yeah, we have a call?
We do have a caller.
Oh, yeah. Let's get a caller then. Okay.
Patrick, come on in. Okay. Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead, please.
Caller, I'm live on the air. I'll introduce myself. I'm a listener to your program. I go by the moniker of Mr. M.
What's happening, Mr. M?
Well,
M, how you doing? Welcome.
I'm doing very well. I'm doing very well. And, you know, I mean, there's so many things going on in this city, and there's so many things. I mean, you talk about, you know, the veterans, and I see a lot of things where, you know, a lot of the states and a lot of areas in the country are striking down things like affirmative action.
Yes.
They're striking down, they're rolling back a lot of the things that started with Brown, the Board of Education, all these things are starting to be rolled back.
Mm-hmm.
And in this city, you know, I noticed something in the paper today, you know, where they're doing a big remodel job over on the Cedar Riverside area. putting a lot of funds in that, and it's supposed to be some low income. They're putting some housing there, but they're supposed to be designating some of the housing for individuals of lower income. So, you know, it's going to be an opportunity. But I'm just wondering if, you know, that area has been really dominated by the Somali population for the last several years. And when I get
Absolutely.
To, you know, and I see a big project like that going on in a certain community, I begin to wonder, as if you were talking about our great veterans earlier, you know, our great veterans have served this country, and in many cases they've, you know, risked their lives for what this so-called freedom that we're supposed to have here in this country. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you how many friends that I had when I grew up that went to Vietnam that came back with their heads turned around in a 360-degree method that they're still suffering from.
Absolutely.
So our veterans deserve something for that. The Native Americans who had their land, I mean, they were here first. I mean, there's no mm-hmm. question about that. They had their land stripped from them, and they were eradicated and placed on reservations. So they deserve something. The African American enslaved in one of the most atrocious treatments in the annals of humanity. You know, now slavery wasn't anything new, but what was new here is you weren't treated as a human being. You're treated as an animal.
Oh, yeah.
So that's how horrible it was. But I still don't understand what the Somali population has done, and I'm not begrudging anybody, but the individuals I've mentioned, the veterans, the natives, the African Americans that have been here in this country that deserve something to give them a leg up or at least give them an opportunity to be in society. I don't see how all this is being put into one community that I don't know what their history is here.
You know, it's an excellent point, and we would certainly encourage representative leadership of the Somali community to kind of tell us in a clear way, in a clear and concise way, what the reward system is all about, if you will, because that's really what we're into. There's some kind of reward system. But my take as a man that is a part of a group that was brought here over 400 years ago in bondage, that the reward system certainly needs to go first and foremost to those who, even under conditions of slavery, served this nation, fought for this nation, certainly fought for their freedom, fought for some semblance of protection for their people, the sons and daughters of the African, if you will. I just don't, I'm not quite understanding as you are, this dismissal of the patriotism of Black Americans. Are you with me on this, Mr. Allen? I'm just not understanding the disregard and dismissal.
I agree.
Because maybe sometimes foolishly, if you will, but we have been defenders of the so-called democratic institutions of this nation. We have paid with our blood, if you will. And let me also say this, I mean, and we have been decorated for our valor, if you will. We have been decorated for the actions that we have carried out, the non-betrayal of our nation and et cetera, and on many regards based on how we as the sons and daughters of the African have been treated for over 400 years. That is a tough chore, but I applaud the African-American, the Latino, the Asians, if you will. I mean, I don't know that people want to remember what happened to Japanese Americans in this country right after December 7th and how
determined
they were imprisoned and et cetera. And so my doctrine is I'm trying to get a feel for what it is that you have done to be rewarded and what it is that you've not done to be disrespected.
you have put my words in a nutshell right there, Mr. Edwards. And you know, and working in the social service area, you know, for so many years here in this area, you know, I see how from the 70s to now how these incarceration rates, especially for African American, have just spiraled.
Yes,
I mean, these incarceration rates in this country, I mean, they dwarf any other country in the world.
In the world, thank you.
I mean, individuals, I mean, at this point now, even if you are a school child, I'm talking about somebody third, fourth, fifth grade, if you're what's described as an unruly child, they may call the police on you. They may arrest that child, and that child may start in the criminal justice system at that young age.
Yes. And by the way, the Department of Justice just came out with a study concurred with by the Federal Department of Education, which shows a 6 times the rate of African-American babies as young as now preschool. I mean, they're arresting black children, incarcerating black children who are, you know, school. Mr. Allen, you know, getting close to the age of your oldest son, if you think about it. And my reflection about what is it that we've done that in this case that we've not done that we are so disrespected as loyal and patriotic Americans, if you will. And it's just, you know, what you talk in terms of going on over in Cedar Riverside, I mean, you're absolutely correct, because a African American, by the way, can't even get accommodations in that big high tower over there in Cedar Riverside.
Yeah, and I know when that thing, when it was built, I mean, I knew a lot of individuals that lived in that very tower, very building.
Yes, I did too. And so I don't know. You know, there's something at play, if you will, as if we owe something to folks. I mean, that's great. But at what point do we owe something to those that have been patriotic and loyal Americans and who have fought for this country and at the same time have spoken out against the injustices of this nation and who have had their leaders extricated and murdered and et cetera? See, when I see groups that have not yet walked that mile, if you will, down that corridor and that highway, then I'm trying to figure out, you know, what is it that they brought to the table? I don't know.
That was my original question. I mean, it's obvious the veterans' contribution. I mean, that's, you know, goes without saying. Mm-hmm. The Native, you know, their rights in this country have definitely been, you know, stripped from them. And African American, you know, all I see is, you know, the high incarceration rates. And then, you know, once you've done that, you know, you put all these individuals, you incarcerate them, but when they get out, well, you let them out. They don't have a penny in their pocket. They have to live in a situation where they're living with maybe 20 or 30 other people in a laying on a cot or something. All they do is go back to what they know.
Absolutely.
You know, without the support. I mean, they've already been branded because they've been in the penitentiary. They're already mm-hmm. branded. So, I have that same question, you know, Mr. Edwards and Mr. Allen, you know, what have we done? You know, why aren't we having a foothold? Why aren't investments being made? Why aren't things being done, you know, visibly to turn these things around? So,
I like the reference to investment. I just feel, I have to say this as an African-American who is 75 years of age and has been in the struggle, if you will, for equality and et cetera, since he was 19 years old, you know. I just don't think that the current administration in City Hall and current administration on the City Council, et cetera, I just don't think that they feel that we're worthy of an investment. I don't think they want to invest in us, that they don't feel that we're worthy of that investment, yet we are still required. We are still required, if called upon, to serve our nation. There is no universal draft here in the United States. We are still expected, quote-unquote, wink, wink, if you will, to be prepared to serve the nation. Every time I look at the pictures of our forces overseas, if you will, and et cetera, and I see young African Americans, though I noticed that the numbers are not what they were during Vietnam, when, you know, 77,000 African Americans lost their lives fighting another man of color. I've always had a great appreciation for the statements of Muhammad Ali, if you will. And so I become more troubled each day, gentlemen, on this end of the microphone with regards to a signal being sent to us. And I think it really started when the Democratic Party, I know Mr. Allen kind of enjoys this, when the Democratic Party made a clear decision that there would be no investment in black Americans, holding any portfolio of political power, et cetera, and for the first time in 33 years, 27 in St. Paul. I don't think that's a coincidence, if you will, that we do not sit at the table of council of power and administration. And we really have no one to speak for us, if you will. There won't be a single mumbling word from any city council member on tomorrow about what the heck is happening. And, in fact, we found that took place, in the so-called gang summit, peace summit that was held at the Urban League. There was no one there that really paid any attention to what African Americans, the sons and daughters of the African, brought here in chains and bondage, what our concerns were. And I'd like to take this whole thing of investment. I'd like for the mayor and the city council and others of this city and the representatives of, in the legislature and et cetera, to indicate what is the investment in the people, not quote unquote in individual hustlers or pimps, but what is the commitment to invest in the future and more importantly now the survival of the African American. Okay,
well, I think the mayor has made a statement. I mean, by publicly wearing a hijab, wearing the garb,
mm-hmm.
attending a meeting of you know, a particular community, showing, you know, that her hand is there with that community, you know, but I haven't seen any similar actions with any other communities. So
I have not either. And as well as the appointment of a special advisory committee, as I've said before, and I'm a historian We'll challenge and confront anybody that wants to deal with it. No mayor has ever, not even the legendary Hubert Humphrey in the 1940s, no mayor has ever said, well, I'm going to appoint a specific committee. I well remember when we brought forward in the 1960s as the, you know, turbulence gripped these cities and many cities across America.
Sure.
And we talked about 26 points, if you will, which included inclusion in government, et cetera. But even then, under that kind of pressure, then-Mayor Arthur Naphlin did not say, I'm going to appoint a committee of African-Americans, though God knows that we had earned that, if you will. And I've never really seen that done. I can appreciate it. Fine, that's been done. But when I see the, you know, black Americans being underemployed, non-employed, undereducated, non-educated, if you will, incarcerated in greater numbers than ever before, and et cetera. You know, I'm wondering, well, maybe the white established institutions need a advisory committee of the real black folks.
Boy, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I look at the administrations now. I mean, the administration we just finished with, the Ryback administration, now the new administration. I mean, I've survived politicians here, you know, Mr. Dietzek, Mr. Stenvig. I mean, I don't think this even rivals the things that were going on years ago.
Under Charles
Stenvig. I mean, I really don't.
Let me just say, for the purpose of historical continuity and reference, when Charles Stenvig, who was a police officer on leave, and people called him, you know, pro-police and et cetera, his chief advisor was an African-American, Mr. Allen, a man by the name of Richard Parker, born in Mason City, Iowa, grew up, came here to Minneapolis at age 6, grew up in North Minneapolis, lived right there in the projects. He was Charles Stenvig. No matter how people talked about Charles Stenvig, Richard Parker was his chief advisor on all matters. And, you know, you look at this current mayor and you go back and look at R.T. Ryback, they never chose to put an African-American in a position of significant policy.
Well, that is a significant statement because, you know, like you said, Mr. Stanley was pro-police, you know, but he was still part of the community, and he respected that there were other people in this community, too.
Yeah.
Whatever he thought of them, I don't know, but he gave them respect.
Yes.
And I don't see, but again, you know, one of your earlier points is, you know, who's demanding the respect? Who's out there, you know, to see that this happens?
Yeah, you can't ask for respect on one hand and wink, wink at Master and say, you know, boss, just slip me an envelope under the table and I'll do your bidding. You don't get respect like that.
No,
can't
but, you know, I think the big fall guy in this Sterling thing really has been the NAACP in a lot of ways. Because
what we were talking about at the very top, and they're catching hell tonight out in California.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, they had the nerve to say they wanted to meet with the commissioner, and a number of black activists said, for what? You know, you've never asked to meet with the commissioner before. Why you want to meet with him now? Because they figure they can get some dollars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Like my dad said, you know, you can't beg a man and fight him at the same time.
No, it doesn't happen.
It doesn't work.
All right, Em, stay tuned, though. We've got a little revealing piece for you.
I will definitely stay tuned
really
and talk to you guys
later. All right, thank you. Interesting, Mr. Allen. The phone lines are still open, aren't they?
I
couldn't be because we have him on. Okay.
Yep,
let me do this to cut to the chase. We've been monitoring the terrorist activities that took place in Overland Park, Kansas, just outside of Kansas City, Kansas, and across the river from Kansas City, Missouri. We are very interested in a court by Mr. Cross, known on the record as Frazier Miller Cross, and that's his real name. Now, this man, Don, you have to have an appreciation of this as a veteran.
Mm-hmm.
He is has been for a long time one of the most dangerous individuals in the United States who has been a part of the pro-Nazi Ku Klux Klan mentality, and he had a court appearance on the 24th in Overland Park in Johnson County, where the three deaths he committed were carried out, and in fact they're contemplating asking for the death penalty. But one of the things that's troubling is that this man has been involved in at least 30 execution and murders of young African Americans over the last 40 some years. And I well remember when he came to my attention as an activist in the 60s and 70s because he served in the United States military for 20 years, from 1959 to 1979, when the federal government, the armed services, asked him to quietly depart after he was involved in the massacre of citizens protesting in Greensboro, North Carolina. Who were called communists. And when Mr. Cross and his associates, acting as military-style militia, shot these individuals down in the streets. Now, 9 years later, he was a suspect in a triple homicide outside of Selby, North Carolina. But I first came across him in 1962. I will not go into the details of how and why that happened, though it had to do with racial conflict in northern Missouri, okay? Came across him again in Idaho, where he was involved in appearance over a period of a couple of years of three young African Americans, all coming, you know, traveling separately, actually coming from out of Minnesota, who disappeared. And two bodies were found, third was never found. And I was very much aware, and this is something that is current enough that people can deal with it, is that he was very much involved in the planning of the Martin Luther King attempted bombing in January of 2011 in Spokane, Washington.
Yeah, I remember that.
We have reported and identified the training sites of these white paramilitary groups, units, and et cetera. And by the way, to our homeboys who run the the very homicidal website called Stormfront. In fact, if you're sitting there on your computer, because I have some other stuff on my computer at this point, if you call up stormfront.com, you will see one of the leading terrorist organizations existing and allowed to exist in the United States, with their prime targets being African Americans, people of color, and Jews. Okay? And so it was interesting on his appearance in court on the 24th of April in Johnson County, Kansas, that Mr. Cross continued to be the tight-lipped. And this is interesting because Mr. Cross also, even while in his last couple of years in the United States in service to the United States Army, was a federal informant until he got himself involved in stealing very sophisticated weaponry from American Army posts, including Fort Lewis, Washington, and et cetera. Also, by the way, Mr. Cross was a very close associate of the man who, Joseph Paul Franklin. So you don't even hear people talk about that, do you, Don? You know
no,
who Joseph
no,
Paul Franklin was?
No, I don't.
He was the man that shot and almost killed Vernon Jordan outside of a motel in Fort Wayne, Indiana. But the key piece for him has been that he has been identified as being one of the planners in the chemical and biological attack that almost was pulled off, if not for the alertness of two Spokane City workers, if you will, who saw the suitcase with the bomb under a bench at a bus stop with about 2,000 marchers and celebrants and et cetera, celebrating the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr. Discussion within law enforcement here in the United States about people like Mr. Cross, like Franklin, like our good friend James Earl Ray's brother, if you will. People don't understand how much of a racist he was. But it is Cross that has disturbed me because of, I mean, we're not talking about somebody, Don, that was a punk. We're talking about a guy that was trained. He was in the elite Green Beret. He was in the Special Forces for 13 years. He was in a number of the pacification / programs in Vietnam, which were nothing more than fronts to murder Vietnamese who were considered to be, for whatever reason, they could be communists, they could be socialists, they could be loyalists, if you will, but were determined to be people that needed to be exterminated, if you will. And this man returned to this country, and he continued to carry out his deeds, as we said before, including significant involvement, basically after a number of years operating out of northern Missouri, if you will, up around Bethany and Camden. He was living in Aurora, Missouri, and et cetera. I bring this forward because there is this quietness about this individual, and there is really quietness about the role that he played in an attempted bombing that damn near was pulled off. That situation in 2011 almost happened. You know, it almost took place. So just wanted to touch on that. Anybody has any calls, any questions about it, feel free to give us a call. Give us that number again, would you, Mr. Allen?
The number is 347-426-3904. And the number is 347-426-3904.
I'm actually looking at the
Stormfront website, latest three posts to yesterday. Adolf Hitler's political statement, the importance of naming a Jew, and Visit Montana are the three top posts there. And I am just looking through this, and Yeah, this is very interesting.
Yeah.
Jews versus
Stormfront. Yes. The Southern Poverty Law Center has been very concerned about their growth. And as I said, some things emerged during the hearing on the 24th of April in Johnson City, Kansas, which is, in fact, Oberlin Park, where the three individuals, none of them Jewish, by the way, were gunned down, a grandfather, his grandson, and a woman who was going to visit her mother, who she had visited every day in the retirement home, if you will. But this man has been Frazier, you know, Glenn Cross, a.k.a. Frazier, Glenn Miller, has been quite the individual. In fact, Don, if you can quickly find it, when you look at him as a young man, when I'm talking in terms of when we were watching him back in the 70s, and particularly after he came out of the military, though he carried out some of his actions while still, and you can appreciate this, Mr. Allen, while still on active duty in the United States Army. He was training hate groups, if you will, he and others. He had a couple of Marines that joined him from Camp Lejeune down there. But he had been stationed out in Fort Lewis. That's how he hooked up with, quote-unquote, his main buddy, if you will. And we will now give the name of the individual so that folks are like, oh, hell. His buddy, who almost pulled off the Martin Luther King Day bombing in Spokane in 2011, is quite an individual. He's what you call a mountain man. Kevin W. Harpham, H-A-R-P-H-A-M. Now, Kevin is serving 32 years in prison, given to him by a federal court in Washington State because of the plot that he was involved in. But one thing that he never did, he never identified his other co-conspirators. He was living like a mountain man in a facility there in northeastern Washington State, just like something out of one of the movies. But the reason that we now identify him is that he was very much involved in the execution of a number of young African-Americans in that part of Washington State and Idaho, particularly up around Sand Point, using the area up around Priest Lake and Priest River, which we've talked about since 2011, if you will, a killing ground. Don, that the system does not want to talk about. So that's why I always have a great appreciation when we have African-Americans who are at least bold enough and have enough intestinal fortitude to say that things have really not changed and they are more dangerous now than at any time, including the 1960s. So I'm glad we called it up. We would encourage some of our listeners to call up the website Stormfront, because for us Black Americans, these folks really not only talk about what they have planned for us, they go out and carry it out.
Mm-hmm.
All right,
yeah.
Now what else we got, man? We're down to about 14 minutes. Again, that phone line, let's get that number again. That phone line is open. Anybody wants to talk about it? Any questions that you may have, you know, the NAACP in trouble in California. Looks like there's some problems here. Looks like there's been a mass departure from the NAACP here in Minneapolis, and wow, I don't know if some of the women in example want to talk about what happened, if you will. And as we said before, and earlier this afternoon, a single gunman opened fire, shooting a couple of people and, causing absolute panic and chaos inside of the medical facility known as the Hennepin County Medical Facility, HCMC. And we were told, Mr. Allen, when the reports were made out of the so-called peace summit, that order had been brought and chaos had been ended.
Yeah. Nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to happen in Minneapolis. We have it under control. Just make sure you fill this duffel bag up with some dead white presidents. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that number is 347-426-3904. 347-426-3904. And we'd really like to hear your opinion in the last 15 minutes here we have about what's going on in Minneapolis and as well as around the world, especially in California and other places. And Mr. Evans, it's really funny because yesterday I was on Kevin McHale's wife, Lynn McHale, decided that I was this knucklehead and she's going to have this conversation with me via Facebook about a statement that Larry Johnson made about blacks should own their own team, their own league.
Now, Larry Johnson, the former New York Knicks great and former member of the champion UNLV team's NCAA Final Four about 27 years ago. Larry Johnson, hell of a – in fact, I think Larry is in the NBA Hall of Fame. But go ahead. What did she say? She was annoyed with you or what?
She's very annoyed with me. She says, how can I say that our team consists – all I can say is our team consists this year of Lithuanians, a Jewish guy, a Hispanic, Turkey guy, an Asian, a couple of white guys, and a few blacks. We have coaches who are white, black, and American Indian.
Wait a minute. What team was she talking about?
I she was talking about the Houston Rockets. Because she wasn't talking about the Timberwolves.
Yeah, because the Timberwolves didn't have any Jewish player. And the Houston Rockets are predominantly black, and her husband is the coach, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I've known Kevin ever since he came down here from, in fact, I at one point refereed a game when he was playing in high school at Ebbing High School. I know Kevin well, watched him as a Gopher at University of Minnesota playing with the legendary Michael Thompson and Ray Williams and et cetera. I'm not understanding why she was aggravated. But, I mean, what was it that you should move on about? I mean, I'm not understanding what she was saying.
Oh, just talking about, you know, because they were posting, they posted on this Sue Jeffer, who works at talk radio station, Friends Talk radio station here in the Twin Cities. And Sue Jeffer thought that Larry Johnson asking for, you know, that started making the statement that blacks should own and should have their own lead was racist. And I told her, I said, posting that and saying that was racist is racist. But it just let their white privilege just came out because they don't understand the significance of, you know, that statement. I explained to her in several statements that, you know, there's nothing wrong with black people owning teams and having their own league. I mean, since when is that a problem? I said, white people own the league now. I said, can't black people own the league? They have Mexican people? You know, Jewish,
well, let
Russian,
me do this for historical importance. She probably needs to understand that there was a time in one sport, baseball, that Negroes, as we were referred to in those days, in formal circles, did have their own league. In fact, I would suggest that one of the things she may want to do next time she travels, maybe on her way down to Houston to visit her husband, you know, is that she may want to stop in my hometown of Kansas City and visit at 18th and Vine the beautiful Negro Baseball Hall of Fame as well as the Jazz Hall of Fame Museum there on 18th and Vine. Beautiful facility. You know, I had visions when I thought that a museum was going to be built here in Minneapolis. I had visions of it looking like the Negro Baseball League Museum / Jazz Blues Museum in Kansas City. But she needs to know that there was a time when we had to. If we wanted to participate in a sport in which we excelled in, baseball,
mm-hmm.
Of course we excelled also in football, basketball, and even hockey, and we'll go to that one of these days if anybody ever has the nerve to call us and ask me about Negroes in hockey. But the Negro Baseball League, in fact, it got to the place where one of the reasons that Branch Rickey indicated as he got ready to bring integration to Major League Baseball with the beloved Jackie Robinson is that he well remembered back in the 1920s, you have to remember the age and timeline, when the Negro All-Stars used to beat the crap out of the white All-Stars, which included Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Chris Spiker and Ty Cobb and all of those. But it was always the position after Major League Baseball was resegregated, per se, in 1902, that a black man had not earned the right to be on the field of competition. And her, you know, her husband, she has to remember, her husband would not have won a couple championship rings and would not be pursuing another championship ring as the coach of the Houston Rockets if those same individuals, the sons and daughters of the African had not finally been afforded the opportunity to integrate the National Basketball League. In fact, let me just say this with regards to whatever her purpose of intent of her statements. As it pertains to major league sports, the Big Four, basketball, football, baseball, and hockey, major league basketball / NBA was the last league to integrate, Mr. Allen. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, professional basketball did not integrate. See, yesterday, and I appreciated Adam Silver, the three-month commissioner, if you will, of the NBA, when he paid homage and respect to Mr. Lloyd, to Mr. Cooper, to Mr. Russell, and to Mr. Jordan and others, because particularly with the case of Dukes and Lloyd and Cooper, those were the Negroes that were allowed to, quote-unquote, integrate professional basketball in 1950. See, when the beloved Minneapolis Lakers were winning championships in 1949 and 48, 49, and 50, and were being called the greatest team in the history of the game, Negroes couldn't play on the same court. In fact, it took the Lakers about 4 years after integration when they finally signed a beautiful gentleman by the name, and when I say beautiful, I'm talking about his personality and et cetera, who, in fact, grew up and lived right around where you live, Mr. Allen, where you grew up as a child in South Minneapolis, named Bob Williams.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
And Bob Williams became the first Negro, quote-unquote, to play for the Lakers franchise, be it Minneapolis or Los Angeles. And so we, you know, to Ms. McHale or anybody else, I mean, we as black people have more than paid our dues. We've more than suffered, if you will, the indignities, if you will, the disrespect, if you will, that has been heaped upon us as we have, you know, gone through the trials and tribulations of trying to, I guess the word I would use, you know, would be to assimilate, you know, to compete and et cetera. So what you were doing, Mr. Allen, is just kind of a part of your DNA and my DNA and any other black person's DNA who is prepared to stand up and who knows their history. So I commend you, man. You know, I don't understand why she thought that Larry Johnson was a bigot, you know, and why it is that. And by the way, I find it interesting, her statement, because she, you know, with her husband being in the NBA as a coach, and certainly a former player and in the NBA Hall of Fame, they're tearing the doors down. They're tearing the doors down as we speak to find the necessary $440 million for Magic Johnson and probably my man Kareem Abdul-Jabbar so that there will be black ownership of the Los Angeles Clippers. Okay?
Wow.
Because it's clear that our friend Donald we encourage people to read our column in next week's edition of the Spokesman Recorder entitled Donald, Donald, Donald. But $445 million will probably get the job done, and there are a lot of important investors out there who want to see Magic and maybe a couple other legends of professional basketball, including Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, have the opportunity to own that franchise in its totality. Because contrary to what they say, Michael Jordan is not the 100% owner of the Charlotte Bobcats, soon to be the Charlotte Hornets. So, you know, maybe white folks need to understand that there are those of us, black folks, you know, as limited and as retarded as they think we are, we do kind of know what the history of this country is.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel, Mr. Allen, that you were being talked to as if you just got here off the boat, you know.
Yeah.
Your lineage, if you will, has been long, if you will. Mm-hmm. So we've known for a long time what's going on this side of the Atlantic.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, if she's listening, Ms. McHale is welcome to call in.
Yes, she is.
Or any of her friends. We've still got, about 5 minutes.
And 5 minutes,
so,
yes.
Phone lines are open. To make us understand why Larry Johnson, former New York Knicks great and star and All-American at UNLV, that's the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, why he some way or another was promoting racism. I don't understand, you know. You know, we play the game, we dominate the game. I would think at some point we should have a chance to own a piece of the game. Oops.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. That's an important piece. People want that. They're scared of a dark nation. Just terrified of a black person.
Yeah, I'm really sorry to hear, particularly from a lady who, you know, should know a little bit better, and certainly her husband has certainly profited, from the success of the NBA, and he's profited from being the general manager / then coach, president of basketball operations for the Minnesota Timberwolves for a decade, if you will. You know, I'm not quite sure that Kevin would specifically agree. And, you know, they just lost a child here a year ago, one of their adult daughters. And, you know, I want to try to be cautious, but I was aware, and it was shared by your staff with me, I was aware of her comments to you. And I think you're right. I think that she just thought you were some colored knucklehead.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And she was going to give you an intellectual education.
Mm-hmm. That's what she wanted to do. Yeah. Tell me how it be.
Yeah. You getting any text messages on this, Don?
I'm getting a couple, but, you know, I'm not listening to them. They got to call into the switchboard and talk to us
right,
that way.
Right. Yeah. Well, we wish him the best. You know, we did try, Mr. Allen tried early in the day to reach the Los Angeles chapter of the, branch of the NAACP to ask if their president, Mr. Jenkins, who was a longtime associate and friend of Donald Sterling, if you will, got a lot of money from Donald Sterling, to make it appear that Donald Sterling, I'm talking about this goes back as far as 2006, Mr. Jenkins, you know that, to carry water, we would say something else, but I want to be keep it civil. But to carry, you know, Mr. Sterling's water, if you will, against allegations of racism, discrimination, and et cetera, and particularly lawsuits, and particularly in the matter dealing with the lawsuit by the Hall of Famer Elgin Baylor, Minneapolis and Los Angeles Laker, now in the Hall of Fame. You know, questions are being asked of the Los Angeles NAACP. How much money did they get from Donald Sterling? What have they done with it? Because someone was saying to me, I got a call just before we went on the air indicating that the NAACP is saying they'll give the money back. And so the activists in California have asked them, well, how much did you get from the white man? I mean, how much did he give you, you know, for you to, you know, kind of be his handmaiden? And now they won't tell. And I think earlier you made mention of the fact that it may even go to litigation, Mr. Allen. As we say,
oh, yeah. They're going to have to find out. They're definitely going to have to find out.
Yeah. I understand that the Lifetime Achievement Award they were going to give him in a couple of days, that he gave him $100,000, which was consistent with what he gave him in 2006 when they gave him the same award. As he was about to lose a $2.75 million housing discrimination lawsuit. He lost that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
so
crazy. That's just crazy. Yeah. You got those folks in that.
Standing that, you know, Donald Sterling is worth $1.8 billion. So, you know, $100,000, man, it's like, you know, some coins, you know, throwing it out to the little native children. Well, all right, Mr. Allen, look like we're ready to wrap it up, man. You know, we'll be back next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday, same bat time, same bat station. Thanks for listening, everyone. And we're going to go ahead and look for James Brown here and let him go ahead and roll us on out here tonight. Thanks for listening.
James Brown,
we'll be back next week.